I recently heard a way of expressing the Buddha's teaching, one of the Buddha's central teachings, as a mathematical formula, which is that suffering or discontent equals pain times resistance. I thought this is pretty good. And I think what this is meant here is suffering or discontent is the issue that we're addressing with practice. And pain in this formula I understand to be mostly like physical pain, physical discomfort or pain. And so if we have some physical pain, that's just part of being a sentient being. But if we resist it, then that creates this unnecessary suffering. And when you set it up as a mathematical formula like this, it's interesting because you can, if you're trying to reduce suffering or discontent, which everybody is, the Buddha understood this, then you could work on either side of this section of pain. You can try to reduce the physical pain, which we do, or you can try to reduce the resistance, or both. If you have 10 units of pain and 10 units of resistance, that's going to produce 100 units of suffering or discontent. But if you have only 5 units of pain but 10 units of resistance, that's only 50 units of suffering by reducing the pain. And maybe if you get the physical pain down to like almost zero, maybe we're like so comfortable physically in some given moment that it's like zero, and then if there's nothing to resist in that case, so then there wouldn't be any, even if you could have resistance, if there was no pain to resist, there wouldn't be any suffering. Maybe something like that. And I think there were, you know, many realms of occupations and activities are about reducing physical suffering. That's the world of like doctors, for example, right? Firemen and all this. And I think Buddhism to some extent is about this too. Or religion in general. I think Christianity tends a little bit more towards the side of reducing the physical pain. There's more like social work and feeding the poor, for example, feeding the hungry, and trying to house the homeless, and so on. And we do some of that here at Zen Center, where we have the global sanghas. It's kind of about reducing the physical, you could say pain through feeding the homeless shelters and so on. But I would say Buddhism is more on the side of like working with the resistance part. It's a more of this internal project. The Buddha's teachings are mostly about working with our mind of resistance. But it's nice to combine both, and maybe if Christianity tends a little bit more towards reducing the physical pain, maybe Buddhism tends a little bit more towards reducing the resistance. But they're both working at these different parts of this formula to reduce suffering, which everybody would agree is most important. So if you have if you have 50 units of physical pain, but only 10 units of 5 units of physical pain and 10 units of 10 units of physical pain and 5 units of resistance, then you only have 50 units of suffering. And in this practice of staying with our experience and so on, that I think the Buddha is proposing that it's possible to reduce the resistance down to potentially zero, which might seem like almost impossible to us, but I think that's the proposal, that if you could have zero resistance to what's happening, then you could have 10 units of physical pain, but when you, in multiplication like this, 10 times 0 is 0. So I think that's why I did set this up as a multiplication equation is kind of nice. And we can work on both sides. And I thought, like, is this really just about physical pain? What about mental pain? And it's somewhat a question for me when I think about it, because I think mostly what mental pain is, or psychological or mental pain, mostly what it is, I think, is actually resistance. Right? So maybe a question could be, are there realms of mental or psychological pain or discomfort that are not resistance? And when I think about my own experience, I think maybe there are. Like my mom died recently, right? And so I knew that was coming. It wasn't exactly the problem that she was going to die. It was somewhat kind of a relief, actually, because she was in a lot of discomfort before then. So, but when she actually died, I felt like this great sadness. But when looking at my experience at that time, I didn't feel like it was really resistance to what was happening. But this should be happening. She should be dying now. And it's not a bad thing. It's not a problem. It's not like it shouldn't be happening. And I wasn't resisting it, and I wasn't resisting the sadness either. I didn't also feel like I shouldn't be sad. I felt like it's appropriate to be sad. So it was emotional. Maybe pain isn't exactly the right word for it, but I think usually great sadness we would categorize as pain. So maybe there's some, discomfort or something like that that we could put in that category of pain without resistance, and therefore not exactly suffering the way we're using the terms here. Does it make sense? And as I say, Buddha Dharma tends to work more with the resistance side, reducing our resistance. And you could even say Zazen is one way of looking at Zazen. It's about this. It's about whatever experience we're having, pleasant or unpleasant, we're just trying to be with it completely, and you could say accept it completely, and just breathe with our experience and settle into our experience and become so intimate with our experience that there's no, it's not like part of the mind is separating from it in order to resist it. Like that's how resistance works. It's almost like our mind sort of splits, and there's one part that's experiencing some discomfort, and then there's another part that's like feeling like that shouldn't be happening. It's resisting. I think you have to have that kind of split to resist. So in our zazen, we're reducing that split. There's just this one experience that's happening, and there's no separation from it in order to resist it. And on the side of reducing physical dis-ease and discomfort and so on, today we're doing this liberating life ceremony. So that's, I think, more on the side of reducing kind of physical suffering and death. We talk about birth, old age, sickness, and death. I think it's more about the physical side. So we're rescuing these crickets that were held captive and destined to become reptile food, and we're releasing them into the wild, so saving their physical lives. We don't know about their resistance so much. I think it's a more subtle thing for humans. We can hear teachings about this and learn how to resist less, but it's hard to convey that to crickets. In a little bit, we try to. In the ceremony, we give these teachings and so on. As I understand it, it's like even though they might not understand English when we're talking to them, if we're doing it with intention, they might pick up on a deeper level of just our connecting with them kind of mind to mind and a level of intention. Maybe we wish for that, we intend for that. And a ceremony like this brings up questions for me too, because what is, you know, sometimes it's obvious if there's a person that needs some assistance, like they're hungry, we can feed them, and they can say, "Do you have some food?" And we can say, "Yes, here." And it seems pretty clear that that's helpful. I think the question that comes up for me in a ceremony like this is, it's not like they're going to be pointlessly killed. They're actually becoming food for other animals. we buy them from the pet store, where they're sold for, I think, like snake food and maybe other like lizards. Yeah. So it's like the snakes and the lizards need to eat too, right? So we, you know, in the natural cycle of things, that's how the snakes and lizards eat. In this case, it's already like humans are completely have interfered with the whole natural cycle already, though, because we're like, you know, selling the snakes and the lizards in the store. I don't know if I guess they're probably bred for pets, and then because of that, then the crickets are bred by humans to feed to the reptiles. So it's a natural thing, but it's completely distorted by human ideas. And so, and therefore, since humans are already a big part of this situation, then I feel like, well, maybe as humans, we can then, these particular crickets, we can release some into the big space of nature. And we might say that's interference with the reptile feeding, but it's already so interfered with. Whereas another situation, I noticed yesterday, I was in the kitchen here and I heard this buzzing sound, and I looked up to see this fly that had been newly caught in a spider web. And the spider, which was actually a tiny spider, smaller than a fly, was like right there next to the fly in the web. And I actually felt some emotion about that. I felt like this buzzing of the fly. I mean, we don't know exactly, but I interpreted that as resistance. Maybe it's not even so much physical pain yet. It is caught in this web and it maybe knows this is not a good situation, and this buzzing of its wings is trying to get out of this situation. So I think even tiny animals like flies and ants, seem to resist pain. They seem to, like if we try to capture them, they seem to want to escape. I don't know if that's technically resistance or if it's just a natural instinct, but maybe resistance is a natural instinct, but a painful one, generally. I imagine even in a fly that's trying to escape its death like this, with great effort often, it looks like when we look at the insects, with great effort, I imagine, I project as a human, that it's kind of like there's some sense of distress, that it's actually would be suffering because of the resistance. Maybe at some point, and in this case, watching the fly and the spider, I didn't know what to do. I mean, my first response was like, oh, there's distress happening. I could actually help the situation, maybe, by going in there and if it's not too tangled up in some permanent way, try to pull apart the web and release the fly, maybe before it goes to its death. And I thought about that, and I thought about this ceremony today, and isn't that what it's about, actually? But my conclusion was like, no, this is just this natural situation. This is how the spider eats too. And would that be, maybe this spider like needs a meal right away for its survival. And that would be like human interference. That's kind of how I felt in the end. It's a little different than the crickets, where humans have already interfered so much. I could say, well, I'm in this house built by humans, and that's where the web has been built, so I'm kind of implicated, or somehow humans have interfered a little bit. It's not like if the web was like on a tree in nature, then it's really a little bit like I really am just a bystander here. So, all these questions arise for me. It's complex. What is the appropriate response to pain, to resistance, to suffering in the human realm and the animal realm and all realms of sentient beings? So I offer all these questions and contemplations. I don't know if you all have any thoughts about either the human world of resistance and pain, and especially this question, that if you have thoughts about, do you also feel like there could be mental or psychological pain that with no resistance, or is psychological pain always at least subtle resistance? That's one question. And then the question is, what about what about nature and human interference with nature? And is human interference actually part of nature? And all of that tangled web. Yes.
This is like a nature thing, but there's a new documentary out filmed in Turkey called Honeyland.
Yeah.
This woman who raises, her own little batch of bees for honey. And she's got...
Oh, yeah, I saw a trailer.
Yeah, really.
Like this, yeah.
And she wears like a hood, and she has the smoke to calm the bees down, but she still gets stung all the time. It's just the nature of...
Yeah, beekeeping.
And... she had to move her hives, and she gets the queen bee in this big basket, and they all go in there. And then she covers it up, and she turns into a backpack. So she has like thousands of bees. So she had to ford this river and move them. And so she moved them into this tree, you know, put them in there, and smoked them all up, and just got stung all up. And the bees were dropping into the water, and she would take a leaf and put the leaf in the water and pull the bees out. Even though she's getting stung, it's probably got stung a million times in her life, she would not let the bees drown.
It was kind of cool. Yeah.
Because they'll climb right on a leaf, because I guess bees drown. They can't swim or something. I thought that was interesting.
Yes. Yeah, the I knew a beekeeper at Green Gulch, and it's interesting to hear from a beekeeper. He had been a beekeeper, even commercially, for a long time, and I think probably represents most beekeepers, is they love their bees.
Yeah.
I mean, they're using them as workers in a way, but they really don't want them to die, and each one is precious, and that, you know, he felt some distress when they would die accidentally.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, she was training some other people to be beekeepers, and she told them only take 50% of the honey.
Yeah.
And then she took some of the honeycomb and put it on a rock for the bees. And I didn't know that bees ate the honey. I thought they made it. But that's why she only took 50%,
so that
they could have the other.
Yeah, they need it too, yeah. Nice.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, relationship with the insect world.
Yeah.
It was so intimate with us.
Yeah.
You know, we wouldn't really be surviving without them.
Totally. As pollinators.
Yeah.
And bees is one way in which it's kind of a problem these days. We're losing the bee population.
It might
really affect humans in big ways in the future.
It's such a complex thing when you talk about resistance.
Yes.
And probably most people sitting zazen a lot of us are dealing with emotional pain, mental pain, not so much physical, although we can't generalize.
Yeah. Sometimes they're combined. You know.
But
no
resistance doesn't mean no action.
Yeah. Do you think there can be emotional pain without any resistance, or is it part of what the definition?
I think it's on a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what we're working on. It's kind of like you have to diminish. You have to diminish the resistance in order to feel the pain.
And get in touch with it.
Yes, to acknowledge it. You know, where is it?
Yeah.
It's in your body, it's everywhere. And I think when that happens, when you have a different equation there, a different ratio, then action can suggest itself, the kind of action.
Yeah.
Not necessarily that you wouldn't necessarily know exactly what to do, but I think that you're impelled when you first stop fighting the feeling of the pain, then to engage with
it. Yeah, you can start working with it. Yeah, if we're really resisting strongly, it's like we're totally caught in the situation.
And
there's no way,
The seesawing back and forth, But when you can acknowledge it, I'm sort of struggling with the word to acknowledge that you're hurting and not resisting as much.
Yeah.
Then you can be more objective, I think, about what's in play there. Where's your part? What are the components?
Yeah.
And where can you make an effective change?
Yeah.
Because I don't really believe that to accept abuse is a Buddha way. And there is, you know, many people and books written on engaged Buddhism, which is action.
Not
just action.
So would we call, maybe we wouldn't call that resistance in the way that we're talking about resistance, but that's another good point, is it could be defined as a kind of resistance.
You want to even change the...
Yeah, in the political realm, we use the word resistance in a positive way, right?
Right.
So, that's interesting.
And also in abusive situations, domestic violence.
It's appropriate to resist, yeah.
To act.
I mean,
there's a physical resistance,
yeah.
You need to do that. But it's also very complex.
Yes, yeah.
That codependence of the situation.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've worked with women who were abused in a situation. And it's just a whole, like a whole syndrome, a whole complex thing.
Yeah. And then there's in the midst of abusive situation, then it seems like then resistance to the situation is the appropriate response. Then another question is, after resisting and breaking free of some situation like that, then the situation's over in the physical happening, but there's all this lingering effects.
Yeah.
And then resistance becomes like a different kind of thing, it seems like. Then it's then more like maybe this is just how, you know, in the realm of time, when we're looking back at something and feeling like that shouldn't have happened, or like, why did that have to happen? We're resisting something that happened in the past rather than the present.
Yeah.
Then that maybe is a different kind. That's maybe a kind of suffering that may not be necessary. Right? We may be able to work with not resisting a past that shouldn't have happened. More like, once it's gone, like now there's a memory, but I don't need to create extra suffering by fueling the resistance of the memory, for example. Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, without denying it either, but...
My sense is that if you're cherishing the memory, then those components might still be active for a repeat.
Yes. Yeah. But
if you're really free... then you don't need to activate a memory to induce the pain as a blame.
Yeah.
You know. Also, like with domestic violence, oftentimes when the person is being abused is freed, gets free, that's when they get killed. Control is gone, and so the ongoing control, that's when they get killed.
Complex.
Very. Very complex.
Did you have a thought?
Going back to the crickets and the interference of humans. And I was thinking about it this morning, about the crickets themselves being let free, and how because they've been living in a little box in a pet store their whole life, they probably don't even know how to live in the world. So then I was thinking, well, what's going to happen? Can they find food to eat? They're out there walking around. They probably just get eaten by birds and that. But I mean, then like what you said, that is more of a natural sort of destiny than the one in the box and then in the aquarium and with no free chance at all.
The setup is so difficult. There's the lizard and there they are and there's no other way. And so I've wondered too what happens to them. I don't know if there's any way they could find out, but I always think about what they eat and so on, and can they find moisture, especially in weather like this. Mm-hmm. I think we should release them in the shade where there's some green, like down at the park here, maybe some of them. But researching a little bit, it sounds like crickets have pretty short lifespans. So I think they might be able to survive before they're eaten by a bird and then just die naturally, which is a kind of beautiful thought. They wouldn't know how to live without their human manufactured food there and all. But that's it. Yeah, I just don't know. I have the hope that that just through their natural instinct, they, you know, what leaves and things like this, that they would, if they're hungry, they would find edibles and protection and shelter and. But even not knowing, that's a little bit how I feel. It's like these two different possibilities. They're going to live in a box in this artificial environment, kind of crowded in with all these other crickets generally. Mm-hmm. And I think that they tend to eat, if one of them dies, they eat each other. Mm-hmm. And it's like, they're sentient beings, so it's like, what kind of conditioning or karmic situation is going on there, and are we supporting? And especially if we are open to this view of this continuum of life from birth to birth, and this all sentient beings have Buddha nature, so it's like they can evolve, and maybe their next life they're human, could be. And so how do we, in this little short lifespan of a cricket, create some good conditioning to so that their consciousness can evolve. And even just the situation of being in an enclosed box versus like open space is, I think that's great conditioning for any sentient beings, including humans. The sense of spaciousness and vastness is kind of related to freedom itself. We don't say that's the freedom of nirvana, is just being in open space. But I think they're somewhat related. We feel different when we're like in a small room in a crowded city versus like on a mountaintop in wild nature. The heart feels different, I think. So I have some intuition that crickets maybe even have some sense of, there's not an edge of our box, just right there. We can just keep walking, and there's no end to this. This kind of the boundlessness of the wild, maybe plant some seeds for opening to the boundlessness of their own Buddha nature. May it be so. And may our human interference with everything, and just being a human, is being born into the realm of interference, like all sentient beings are. Yeah. And then once they're embodied, then they are an interference, good or bad, in this world. And so may all our human interferences be of benefit, and since we don't know whether they will or not, we can intend them to be. May our unknown actions be of benefit. May releasing these crickets actually benefit them instead of harm them. We may harm them more. We may create more suffering. We really don't know. But may our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way.